Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features Ben Fletcher and the IWW, International Labor Organizing, and the vital role of dock workers. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Muizo Muntali. The music in the background is Rain Check by Sonny Rollins as we commemorate his birthday, which is September 7th. As we commemorate Labor Day this week here in the U.S., the show today features a discussion from our archives that not only contextualizes labor as a broader category, but also how it leads to specific radical movements. Professor Peter Cole also focuses on the role of African-American labor organizer Ben Fletcher of the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, also known as the Wobblies, in mobilizing workers in the early 20th century, connecting that movement's similarities to the new wave of unionizing that bypasses mainstream organizations. In his most recent book, Ben Fletcher, The Life and Writings of a Black Wobbly, Dr. Peter Cole tells the story of a hero of the American working class. As noted in the book synopsis, quote, in the early 20th century, when many U.S. unions disgracefully excluded black and Asian workers, the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, warmly welcomed people of color in keeping with their emphasis on class solidarity and their bold motto, an injury to one is an injury to all. A brilliant union organizer and a humorous orator, Benjamin Fletcher was a tremendously important and well-loved African-American member of the IWW during its heyday. Fletcher helped found and lead Local 8 of the IWW's Marine Transport Workers Industrial Union, unquestionably the most powerful interracial union of its era, taking a principled stand against all forms of xenophobia and exclusion. Dr. Peter Cole is professor and graduate director at the Department of History, Western Illinois University. Professor Cole researches the history of social movements, especially how workers and labor unions organize in ethnically and racially diverse societies. He also maintains scholarly interest in the history of African Americans, deindustrialization, South Africa, cities, technology, popular culture, historical memory, and the maritime world. He is a research associate in the Society, Work, and Development Institute of the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa. Cole is the founder and co-director of the Chicago Race Riot of 1919 Commemoration Project. Cole's most recent book, Ben Fletcher, The Life and Writings of a Black Wobbly, is a much revised and greatly expanded version of the one first published in 2006. Other books and publications include Dark Power, Race and Activism in Durban and the San Francisco Bay Area. His chapter, Durban Dock Workers, Labor, Internationalism, and Pan-Africanism, published in Choke Points, Logistics Workers and Solidarity Movements Disrupting the Global Capitalist Supply Chain, Wobblies on the Waterfront, Interracial Unionism in Progressive Era Philadelphia, and is co-editor of Wobblies of the World, Global History of the IWW. Here is Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope with Dr. Cole and the conversation.
Thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us today to have a very robust conversation around the work that you have been doing, Peter Cole, around the IWW, the Wobblies, of course, and also, you know, this labor as a broader category, but also how it leads into specific radical movements. There's an extensive cachet of work that you have developed, Wobblies on the Waterfront, one of your first books, Wobblies of the World, a Global History. You co-edited Dock Worker Power, Race and Activism in Durban and San Francisco, I guess, say South Carolina, and Ben Fletcher, of course, one of your latest works. And what I hope we can do today I don't even know if we could do this in one sitting, but really just kind of unpack or at least lay the frames or the paths that would allow anyone who engages this conversation and is inspired to engage any part of your work, that they can pick up on the themes that kind of connect. What is it that you're intending to do in the context of studying, presenting history to explain the present and mapping the future? What can they pull on? What thread did they pull on and kind of ride that wave, into the moment? And of course, this moment is very interesting. You know, there's a rise of labor activism. There's a strong independent current of activism that is going, that is kind of reminiscent of what you study, reminiscent of the IWW. So with that being said, again, thank you. No long introduction. This is probably the most that people will hear about me, hear me in this conversation, because I'm just going to kind of guide it. But thank you for taking the time to join us, Pierre Cole.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation. It's an honor also, as always, to talk with someone who's knowledgeable about these same subjects and to sort of speak with the people who you've connect with in your way you sort of on your platforms. Right. Thanks. My pleasure. Yeah.
And it's very important, because I'm glad you said, you know, this notion of a platform, because, you know, one of the areas or one of the important platforms that you study in the context of radical labor organizing is the port, or what we can just basically say a portal, you know, portal to the world. But before we begin to get there, let's just go broad, and then we'll just kind of, map it out from there. Who is the IWW? What can the history of the IWW teach us about the present moment? And more importantly, what are some of the themes as you lay out? Because I'm very interested in the broad spectrum organizing that is in the context of the IWW, this notion of connecting social justice grassroots struggles, but also workplace struggles. There is no separation into that. So let's start there and we'll map it out from there.
Of course, we could talk for an hour just about that. In 1905, when the Industrial Workers of the World, or IWW, was founded in Chicago, which is where I'm speaking to you from today, imagine a world where sort of a very small number of people and corporations control much of the wealth, where the government essentially is subservient to these big corporate interests willingly, right? That both main parties actually are sort of serving the interests of capitalism, you could say, fairly, I think, and would have been proud to say it. But also imagine a time with where xenophobia was rampant, where racism was rampant, where sexism was rampant, where nationalism, sort of a corollary to xenophobia, was rampant, but also a time where the labor movement was very, very weak. Where the existing unions, most of whom were in the American Federation of Labor, or AFL, chose to organize only a small sector of the working class, right? Like chose to organize only skilled workers, generally men, generally white men, generally men of native-born descent, excluding, therefore, women, African-Americans and other workers of color, and at least some, if not many, immigrants, which is to say that the existing labor movement chose to not organize the majority of the working class, right? And therefore, a group of radicals, socialists, unionists, anarchists, and others from the U.S. and other countries met in Chicago in order to create a new vision based around a new institution, the Industrial Workers of the World, which was a union, because although they were Marxists, they were not socialists. They didn't believe in social democracy then represented by the Socialist Party of the United States, and also sort of European social democracies. This precedes, of course, the birth of the Soviet Union and communism, but they weren't communists either. And although influenced by the anarchist tradition, weren't quite anarchists either, right? Like, and so it's sort of a radical revolutionary left union that saw the pathway to socialism to come through where ordinary people had their greatest power, which was at the workplace, and that the greatest weapon of workers was the strike. And of course, in 1905, this was 30 years before American workers had the legal right to unionize or strike. And so, in fact, most strikes historically were the right to force employers to negotiate, right? Because employers had no legal obligation. Of course, in our time, we might see Starbucks and others having a legal right to negotiate, but failing that and hiring activists, et cetera, right? So the IWW was founded. To build a new society from within the ashes of the old, their language, right? Which is to say, through some collective general strike, a new society would be born. That society would not be an American society, but a global society. That's why their name is the Industrial Workers of the World. They, in fact, chose to name themselves that. They did not name themselves, as some suggested, the Industrial Workers of America, because they understood capitalism as a global system. And therefore, the solution to be a global one, right? That also meant that all workers are on our side and employers on the other. Famously, in their preamble, workers and employers have shared nothing in common. So that means that although we are different in many ways, Black workers, immigrant workers, women workers, we're all workers, right? And that is only the only ones who win if we divide ourselves are the bosses, right? And so it would be stupid as well as illogical, right? As well as unsuccessful to sort of promote divisions based on race, on nationality, on sex, on type of work one does, et cetera. Now, these are big ideas, right? Like, and they're not unique and they're not actually brand new, although some of them are, right? They're part of a longer tradition and others will build on the IWW or take some things from the IWW, right? But that was their sort of general notions when they sort of came together in 1905. And then, over the next 15 years or so, they became undeniably the most powerful revolutionary union in the United States and among the most powerful in the world, which also helps explain why employers and the government hated them and deeply persecuted them. And while they didn't drive them out of existence, they largely drove them out of power by the mid 1920s, if not sooner. So that's maybe a good start on the IWW.
Yeah, and no, let's contextualize the history right now. I mean, I think it's very, very important to talk about, you know, this is in the context of a global economic shift that is happening after the Civil War, that's having implications or ramifications across the world. At the same time, you know, this is after the 1884 Berlin Conference that is happening. There is a push to really consolidate after chattel slavery and global economy that is based upon extraction of resources and labor. So this environment becomes a very important environment to kind of look out and place, the formation of the IWW in a contextualized global history. Again, pun intended, for global history and the work that you co-edited it as well. Could you talk a little bit about some of those currents that was happening that allowed it to be a very, very rich, robust platform?
Yes, well, I mean, so again, it founded and based in Chicago, at that time, the greatest industrial city in the United States and perhaps the world, right? Like, the US by the early 20th century has supplanted Britain and Germany as sort of the most industrially strong nation, if not the most militarily and politically one. The US already, of course, had an empire, informal. IWW was especially strong in industries that were sort of really resource extraction, natural resource extraction, that actually could easily apply to much of the colonized world as well as actually the United States. Like, and so the miners, copper miners out west, farmers out west are two examples of, or agricultural workers out west, two of the industries that the IWW was strongest in the United States, which was their base, if not their only place. Very quickly, within a few years, IWW ideas and organizers, every IWW member was an organizer. They didn't really have paid organizers. They were true believers that the revolution was coming soon. And so, like, within a few years, Canada and Mexico had locals right? There's the IWW is actually very strong in sort of the mines of northern Mexico, but also in the greatest oil city, port city, Tampico on the Caribbean coast of Mexico near Veracruz, right? But the sailors actually from the IWW started organizing across South and Central America. So it was very strong in Chile, for example, all the way across the Pacific to Australia, New Zealand. The first union in New Zealand, then basically, I mean, part of the British Commonwealth, to organize Maori, right, the indigenous people of New Zealand, was the IWW, right? Because they were not just anti-racist in the United States, they were anti-racist everywhere they went, including Australia, which was a deeply racist society, where the Aborigines were sort of almost wiped out, but also where Asians, Australia being close to Asia, were essentially denied admission for the better part of a century. The IWW also managed to make its way down to Southern Africa, then actually also still part of the British Empire, right? Not yet independent until 1910, right? Was the first predominantly white union or radical organization to organize Black Africans, right? And all along the way, they brought this motto of theirs, an injury to one is an injury to all. That's sort of like a short version of an even shorter word, solidarity, which are sort of the core values of the IWW, which sort of explain we're all in this together. No transgender bathroom divisions here, right? We're going to focus on who's got the power and what's the source of power, which is economic power. With the goal to sort of essentially seize that power, right, for all of us, right? The global context is important, I agree. The IWW also organized in numerous countries in Europe, including England. But it's noteworthy that the IWW spread to maybe Asia the least so, but like at least five of the six populated continents, right, within a decade, right, like this small, plucky revolutionary outfit, which is why they captivated many people's attention, is because they seem to sort of be, well, revolutionaries in their beliefs, which means that they were committed, so that they were willing to do more, right, than others were, not simply to get a raise, although they were not opposed to workers earning more money and work for fewer hours. But those are short-term goals, right? And they also very much had long-term goals.
And the proliferation of these core values, of course, you know, is very important in the context of the internationalism, which is a theme that you're studying. And that internationalism is moving through, as I mentioned earlier, as we opened up the conversation, this notion of port or dock workers, ports, portals. When we look at revolutionary thought, particularly even during anti-slavery movements, we look at the connection of the radical Black radical thought or Black radical traditions. It moves. I mean, you get pamphlets that David Walker's pamphlet that is moving through ports. You get the papers and information that is moving in and out of very, very marginalized societies, whether it's apartheid South Africa, Jim Crow United States. These ports become these intellectual and also practical grounds of development, particularly in labor organizing. You know, these are workers at the dock, but they're also going home. So there's no separation of anti-capitalism that is a strand, and also the notion of anti-racism that is happening as well.
So yes, I mean, the first industry of capitalism is born with the first sort of means that Europe comes to dominate the world for the last 500-600 years, right? Which is the ship, right? European shipping technology was supreme in the 14 and 1500s, the Portuguese and the Spanish, later the Dutch, the French, the English, et cetera, right? Like that's how they came to conquer the world, right? Maritime industry also can be understood as the first industry, right, of the capitalist world. And as others, including Marcus Rediger, have said, you might think of the ship as the first factory, right, where there's this clear division between us and them, between workers and employers, and no chance for workers to become ship owners, right? Of course, that workforce was also polyglot, right, including people from whatever flag nation that they flew, but also from their colonies, And so, of course, the literature of Herman Melville is replete with Black and brown workers, right? Indigenous people, as well as Africans, as well as people of African descent who had ended up in the Americas, right? Who populate the ranks, right? Like, and so, and many sailors didn't sail for their entire lives. A lot of them ended up in port cities when they, you know, stopped shipping, and might end up working on the waterfront in another capacity, right? Unloading and loading ships, right? And so, you know, like you said, there's a long history of Black maritimers. Of course, that goes originally to Africa in sort of pre-modern times, but also in sort of the last three or four centuries. Like you said, it was Black sailors who were smuggling David Walker's appeal into Southern ports and therefore were not allowed to disembark, for example, from Charleston, because they were understood to be a threat, spreading the word not only of Walker's appeal, but also the Haitian Revolution, famously, right? Like, and were very supportive of and helpful in and part of these sorts of local, regional, global networks of to help Africans escape, right, from slavery, not just in the United States, but also outside, right? And then in the 20th century, well, of course, we are who we were, right? And so many African Americans remain dock workers and sailors, right, particularly in the Southeast, but also in some places outside of the American South, Philadelphia being actually pretty close to the American South, and having the largest Black population outside of the American South at the turn of the 20th century, right? And of course, one of those people is a man named Ben Fletcher, whose parents were migrants from Virginia, fleeing, we might say, the racial violence and terror of the 1880s, like as Jim Crow is about to emerge and as Reconstruction has been defeated, right? Why their parents leave, his parents leave, we don't know for sure. Were they enslaved themselves as children born before the Civil War? Very likely, although that's not certain. But Ben Fletcher, born in 1890 as a native son of Philadelphia, joins the IWW in 1910, right? And the Socialist Party, although he'll probably leave the Socialist Party soon after, right? And starts to organize. He's probably the first African-American organizer in the IWW, at least in Philadelphia. At that time would have been a white majority institution. And Fletcher was also probably working as a dock worker, a longshoreman. At that time, the entire workforce was male, so longshoreman wasn't inaccurate if gendered. Now we might say longshore worker. I also use the word dock worker for nowadays. You know, that Fletcher was a working class Black man from Philly. Why does he join the IWW? I wish I knew, although I could guess, right? Well, the system didn't work for him, right? Like he was a Black man. He was a working class man. He was born into a poor family. He was a day laborer and at least some of the time used his strong back to load and unload ships because Philly was the third biggest city and maybe the fifth biggest port in the country at that time. And there was thousands of men who worked on the waterfront in Philadelphia and other port cities, Irish and Irish American, East European immigrants, African Americans, all sort of would have toiled on the Delaware River, which is the east side of the city of Philadelphia. And on the east side of the Delaware River, of course, is New Jersey, Camden, New Jersey, specifically. This is sort of the world where suddenly the IWW emerges, not just in general, but on the Philadelphia waterfront, because they have a handful of dynamic leaders. They've organized other industries in Philadelphia, including textiles, which had several hundred thousand workers in Philly. You've got this African-American leading a predominantly white institution at that time. I cannot imagine there were many others of that sort in 1913. When in May of 1913, 4,000 to 5,000 dock workers, essentially the entire workforce of the Philadelphia waterfront, struck. They struck to be recognized, to have a union. They struck to get raises. And out of that was born an IWW affiliate, often called Local 8 of the Marine Transport Workers Industrial Union, led off and on by its most well-known member, Ben Fletcher, who was also a dynamic speaker and was quickly dispatched to other ports on the East Coast, especially ports where there were African-Americans or other Black people. So Norfolk, Virginia, being a nearly all Black longshore workforce, Baltimore having a significant African-American dock workforce, or even Providence, Rhode Island, which had a lot of Blacks from the Azores and Cape Verde, which were, of course, Portuguese colonies, right? And you may know that southern New England, right, has a Portuguese population to this day. Some of those are Black Portuguese people, right, or people that were colonized by Portugal, which, of course, was the first European colonizer of Africa and developed plantation sugar in the 15th century. And so, like, it all comes together, right? And Ben Fletcher becomes very effective at unionizing Black and white workers, and very effective at thumbing his nose at the bosses, I guess we could say, right? Like, especially because he was known also as not just brave, but also very humorous. And so he could brilliantly explain why workers needed to unionize across racial and ethnic and national divides.
Which is very important because, I mean, this is also a form of obviously organizing intelligence, being able to really take complex or what seems to be complex ideas of how to organize, what the bosses are doing to the workers and how they're doing this in very, very covert ways, and him being able to articulate, those exploitative practices becomes very important. And so we'll get to Ben. We'll definitely get to Ben Fletcher just a little bit more. But before we go there, I want to just take a moment to pause on dock worker power. We talked about this, and this is a material example of what we're talking about. These broad, basic, what seems to be broad, complex yet basic ideas of the relationship between living wage, safety. And also education and in the communities and safety for communities outside of the workplace. Your work in dock worker power really is that shows that. Could you talk a little bit more about the relationship? Because it seems to me that you talk about technology in there, which is a real important. There's a couple of themes, but technology is one of those themes that I think is really important to talk about at this particular. Talk a little bit about, dock worker power, your book, Dock Worker Power, those relationships, international relationships, and how fighting for equality in the workplace in one's local place, one locality, is also simultaneously being done in international context as well.
Of course, I'd love to do that, hopefully succinctly. Dock workers, I say, have power for a bunch of reasons, but if we sort of just move backwards to the word strike, which I suggested earlier is maybe workers' most powerful weapon, that has a maritime origin, right? Like, I mean, it was sailors in London, England, the most powerful port in the world in the 18th century, where sailors took down the sails of their ship, which is to say they stopped work and they wouldn't put the sails back up until they got a raise. The nautical term is to strike the sail, right? Like, and that becomes the word that we all use to this day in every workplace shutdown, right? It sells you again the sort of importance of maritime, right? Like, the trade is really sort of the foundation for economic exchange, and that preceded capitalism. But in the capitalist era, right, trade is sort of remains sort of fundamental. It's an industry, right? Like, and those who work in that industry potentially have power, especially, I say now we use this term supply chain, right? Like, and any chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Another way to think about that is whoever is able to sort of break that link. Right, like, who can break those links? Well, collective workers, individual workers stop, it's irrelevant, right? But if all the workers in a particular port or particular coast or particular industry coordinate collectively, right, they potentially have greater power, right? And so that is why I focused on the US West Coast, because the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, ILWU, remains to this day among the strongest unions remaining in the United States, but also across the world. This union remains disproportionately unionized, whereas very few workers and very few workplaces actually are unionized. And so I'm interested in that. I think that's really important to understand. I don't want to sort of only focus on people who work in logistics. Workers outside of that industry also potentially have power, although not all workers are equally powerful, right? There are some industries, I believe, that actually are more interesting to sort of organize or important to organize because of their centrality, right? And so keeping that in mind, and if you accept that, right, my book, Dock Worker Power, then says, okay, what have workers done not only to improve their own material conditions in the short term, what else have they done with that power? And I've suggested that the ILWU on the West Coast, especially its largest local, which was before the 1980s the largest port in the West, San Francisco and Oakland, that those workers use their power on behalf of other causes, including racial equality, as well as against colonialism, fascism, and imperialism. Right. So, for example, the ILWU Local 10, the San Francisco Local, was 99% white upon birth. When I say 99%, that's not an exaggeration. Right. Like, but within by the mid 60s was majority African American. Right. Like, with also other workers of color in addition. Right. Like, and so that union, which was led and had many in the ranks who were radical whites, essentially actively diversified itself. This is in the generation prior to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which mandated the end of segregation. And so I say that basically workers integrated their ranks, but also promoted racial inclusion from below, as opposed to being forced from above by policy or employers, right? Local 8, just to confuse us, in the IWW did the same thing on the Philadelphia waterfront in the 19-teens. They actually sort of actively integrated the ranks of dock workers when employers had created segregated gangs, right? Like, and they didn't do this, didn't negotiate it. They actually simply started doing it, right? Like, it's, these are suggestions of power. I also note that in my book, Dock Worker Power, that black workers in Durban, South Africa, Durban being the largest port in South Africa and busiest port in Africa for many generations, and still among the most important ports in the Southern Hemisphere, right? That they also engaged, even though they didn't have legal rights because of apartheid, to unionize or strike, they nevertheless organized collectively to try to drive up their wages, but also to resist the system of apartheid, because you could not sort of disentangle political and economic power in South Africa, or I would suggest anywhere, but in particular in South Africa, sort of obvious that the state is enforcing apartheid, right, and created apartheid, right? And just to sort of tie these together, right, that San Francisco Bay Area dock workers on multiple occasions in the early 60s through the late 80s agitated on behalf of, in solidarity with, black workers in South Africa by refusing to unload cargo that arrived on ships that carried South African cargo, right? And so to engage in political activism. Africa.
As we commemorate Labor Day this week here in the U.S., the show today features a discussion from our archives that not only contextualizes labor as a broader category, but also how it leads to specific radical movements. Professor Peter Cole also focuses on the role of African-American labor organizer Ben Fletcher of the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, or also known as the Wobblies, in mobilizing workers in the early 20th century, connecting the movement's similarities to the new wave of unionizing that bypasses mainstream organizations. The music in the background is Africa, Center of the World by Fela and Roy Ayers, commemorating Roy Ayers' birthday, which is September 10. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW, 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
Your dock workers generally's job is to load and unload whatever is on the ships, right? They don't ask where this is from and what they're doing. But on these cases, and I should note, they did this in other situations to protest fascism or imperialism in other countries. They selectively chose to not load or not unload cargo to engage in political activism, right? So instead of waiting for the U.S. State Department to sort of take a stand on what in other countries' politics are about, that working people themselves can do so. And I also then talk about how Durban dock workers have done that on occasion, both historically for a few days in 1935 after the Italians invade Ethiopia. Dockers in Durban and other ports in southern Africa refused to load food that was intended for the Italian invading army, right, led by Mussolini, right? And in more recent times, to protest against the brutal regime of their neighbor in Zimbabwe, that in 2008 were using guns to kill the people of Zimbabwe so that Robert Mugabe could maintain power. And so these Durban dockers refused to unload weapons intended for their landlocked neighbor Zimbabwe. Right. Like, and we could even talk further about those sorts of things. Right. But those are examples of how A, dock workers have power, B, how they've used that power, right, intentionally for political ends, not simply to improve their own short term material interests. Although I do think that unions should and do that also. Right. I'm happy to make more money and work fewer hours. Right. But that's not the only thing that a union potentially can do. Most unions don't engage in this sort of activism. Some do, and not just dock workers and not just these. Right. And of course, it implies that all unions could. Right. Now, as for the technology aspect, if I could just quickly attempt to sort of talk about that. Well, technology changes. Right, like change is constant, and the way we do things involves change, right? Like that is what it is. The question always is who benefits and who loses when changes occur, right? And also keeping in mind that we historians appreciate nothing is inevitable, right? How things happen varies, right? Like, and depends on who has the power. And so as the traditional ways of loading and unloading ships changed in the 1960s and 70s, through a process called containerization. Containers, these 40-foot metal boxes that we're all familiar with. We see them on the backs of trucks. We see them on railroad cars. We also see them, thousands of them now, on ships. This new system was actually born in the United States in the 1950s and 60s. The ILWU on the West Coast was the first dock union to negotiate the transition, and the Port of San Francisco really the first union to deal with automation, if we might also call it that. There were huge consequences of that, right? Now this union had some power, but limited power, and in a country that was very pro-capitalist and very anti-union, right? And so they negotiated a relatively good deal for their current members, which is to say they commanded a share of the wealth. Right. What happened was shipping profits would soar as productivity soared, but also as the total number of workers in that industry plummeted. Right. Like, and so the effects of that is that today, still, and also on the East Coast of the United States, dock workers make really good money, right, for working class manual laborers, right? More than many professors, as I like to say. And if I couldn't be a professor, I might want to be a dock worker if I could get into the ILWU. Angela Davis has said that, but I actually independently also have said that, although I later learned she says it too, right? Like, although I appreciate that more people hear her. They are still a small percentage of the total cost of shipping. But because there's so few workers and the technology is actually mighty, right, that productivity increases. And that resulted in a huge increase in the amount of trade around the world. It also resulted in another unintended consequence, the movement of manufacturing from Europe and North America actually to Asia, right, which is a whole other thing, but of course is another consequence of containerization, right? Like that's enormously important, right? And that did weaken workers, right? Like, and so, like, mindful of that. And in Durban, by the way, it resulted when it was introduced in the late 70s in a 50% decrease in workers overnight, right? Without a penny of earnings going to workers because they didn't have a union that was strong enough to sort of command a share of the wealth or a share of the machine, as they said in the 60s in San Francisco. So, of course, we continue to face issues related to automation, and some of us fear it and some of us embrace it. It's selective, and it depends on where we are, right, in the world and the economy, right? Like professors are now thinking about AI and our students, right? But other people are thinking how great it is, right, that AI will be able to help me sort of make my tasks easier, right? Like, and so as usual, the question is who wins and who loses, right? change and technology being one aspect of change will continue, right? Like, but in a society where the few don't control the wealth, actually technological change might be much better, right? Like, and so like, I don't think that dock workers were anti-technology, but I do think that all workers are worried when technology is introduced by employers, are done so without sort of mutual consent, and also asking who sort of are the beneficiaries, including economic beneficiaries, of when technologies are introduced, right? Like, and so dock workers are sort of the canaries in the coal mine, you might say, when we think about technology and change. But of course, many others were thinking about it too, including famously Martin Luther King in the 60s, but James Boggs, whose work I've been trying to read more of recently, who actually took some views on automation that I'm not sure I agree with, but I'm interested in knowing what he thought, because I think those are, well, we have to grapple with these issues, right? Like, but King and Boggs are actually two of the most important African-Americans in the 1960s who are seeing how automation wasn't just impacting the waterfront. That's actually a small number of workers, but many other industries, most famously, as you know, the introduction of cotton machinery in the 40s and 50s and 60s drastically reduced the number of Black workers in cotton production, right? Like, and although those jobs might have been bad, it's better than not having a job, right? Like, and so fast forward, we might think these issues resonate and are relevant to us today.
No, and it's very important, because I'm glad you mentioned James Boggs, because I've been for about a year now, I'm working on doing a lot of specifically political education in the context of labor, working with a number of groups doing that. And James Boggs, of course, coming out of the League of Black Revolutionary Workers out of Detroit, the Black Workers for Justice in North Carolina, you know. And so just thinking about that in the context becomes a very important point. But one of the things that I want to, as we kind of put a pin in our conversation, because again, I don't want to take too much of your time, but again, we could talk about, there's so much that we could talk about. What is interesting about this environment, there are multiple prongs, there are multiple components that are happening in the context of workers, whether it's on a dock workers in relation to other industries that are organizing. And the IWW seems to me to be a very inviting, flexible, but yet staunchly principled radical organization. And to me, there seems to be a relationship between the collective idea of organizing, but also the idea of leadership not being in a structured, limited conceptualization of leadership, which brings in Ben Fletcher. Right. You mentioned Ben Fletcher. You gave a little bit of that particular history. And Ben Fletcher seems to be one who's able to articulate those, the ideas. There's anarchism that's here. That's very important. That's the idea of the capitalist, the state. There's all of these carrots that are being really fashioned by the IWW and the workers, who have a very clear understanding of the relationship between the workplace and also the environments within which the workplace is also connected to. So with that being said, those strands of idea, could you talk a little bit about, the platforms, the use of ideology and theory in the context of organizing? And you could do that in the context of Ben Fletcher as an example of that.
Of course, I'll try. You know, Ben Fletcher, very intelligent, not formally schooled, as far as we know, probably didn't graduate high school. Of course, most working class boys didn't graduate high school in the early 20th century, right? But we know from his writings and way people commented on his speeches that he was deeply knowledgeable. Many dock workers and maritime workers had free time, especially in the winter, right? And so they would have been they were voracious readers. We also, even from the sort of when they were imprisoned, Fletcher and other Wobblies during and after World War I in Leavenworth, we know that they were reading, right? Like they sort of talked about the books they were reading and had reading groups and whatnot, right? Like they were very interested in understanding the world that they lived in, right? And understanding why things were the way they were. And for Fletcher, as I don't think I would call him an anarchist, but Fletcher and probably the great majority of African Americans, I would suggest, had no reason to believe in the democratic political system in the United States because it had done so poorly by African Americans. Of course, women couldn't vote, period, at that time, right? But Black men had been disenfranchised, right? Like, and so, like, you know, why say that we're going to achieve sort of radical results through the ballot box, right? When the ballot box is actually simply unavailable. Many European immigrants chose not to naturalize, actually, until World War I and after, where there was a, quote, Americanization campaign, because there was a lot of people going, what's the point of becoming a citizen? Which is to say that the majority of dock workers in Philadelphia probably couldn't vote, even though they were men, right, like before 1920, right? Like, and so that sort of pitch, vote for candidate X or Y, you could just sort of put it aside, right? Like they understood very well, and Fetcher could explain very clearly why it was that we needed to organize at the workplace, right? Because that was where people, ordinary people, which is to say working class people, had power potentially, right? Like, and so there were of course others, including I like to note some Spanish anarchists who made Philadelphia their home in the 19-teens who probably would have, explained their views on these issues in a slightly different way, right? And that some of those Spanish sailors worked sugar ships that came from Cuba, particularly, but maybe other Caribbean places to sort of bring the unrefined sugar that was refined on the Philadelphia waterfront. And I should note for those who are unaware that most American big port cities had sugar refineries, right? And would have essentially provided sugar for those regional economies, right? Like, and so these folks are coming up from Cuba. Of course, there's a deep and long tradition of anarchism in the Iberian Peninsula and then the Caribbean, right? And that some of those folks sort of spread their word and make their homes in U.S. cities, right? Like, and so they would have had. One of those guys, Manuel Ray, ended up in prison with Fletcher in Leavenworth, right? Like, and so they would have been in this multiracial, multinational community, right? And that no doubt would have been fascinating, right? Of course, also before the car, they all would have lived close together and could have walked or taken those short streetcars. And now in the US and many countries, there's a very different way we live. We are much more physically dispersed and segregated, right? By class as well as race. And so there's that, right? Like, but Fletcher would have sort of been sort of talking in those sorts of ways, especially suspicious of statism, but also suspicious of the AFL. Fast forward to our decades, right? This wave of new unionism happening, you know, especially in retail, especially in food service, at REI, at Starbucks, at Amazon, at Apple, at Trader Joe's, at Home Depot, et cetera. Many of these workers are not organizing in traditional unions, right? The AFL-CIO is sort of caught flat-footed. Now, I'm a member of the American Federation of Teachers, which is in the AFL-CIO, right? But I'm mindful that actually to this day, many mainstream unions don't devote the majority of their resources, which is to say their money, to organizing, right? They're basically serving the current membership, which may or may not be progressive, right? It's exciting to see young people, not only young people, but disproportionately young people thinking that unions are a path towards short and long-term wealth and power. It's depressing to see that many mainstream unions, even a few years into this, have been incredibly slow to sort of encourage this, right? If I was the American Federation of Teachers or the United Mine Workers or insert any union here, I would be hiring 5,000 organizers, right, including those Starbucks workers who are being fired by Starbucks for unionizing, right, and throwing them into union campaigns across the country, just like happened actually in the mid and late 1930s, when in fact the United Mine Workers and other unions were hiring and throwing in radicals into union campaigns, because you take advantage of these moments, they are rare. We don't need to talk about Joe Biden as the most pro-union president in US history, as he claims, mm-hmm. right? But we can be aware actually that he's less anti-union actually than many presidents, right? That there's all this energy, right? In many places, the IWW's principles resonate, right? Because their direct action, they're radically inclusive, Although the Wobblies historically weren't talking about homosexuality and LGBTQ, right? That's sort of a part of this, right? They're very anti-xenophobic, and that too resonates, I think, with a large number of people around the world, right? In a time where the America actually has its high rate of immigration today as it did in the early 20th century, right? And so like IWW and similar organizing strategies are really where we see Amazon labor unions, Starbucks workers, REI workers, they're doing this, they're doing it peer to peer, right? They're often sort of workers in one Starbucks location are actually the ones who are being reached out to by unorganized workers in other Starbucks in order to tell me how to do this. How can we do this using the same technologies that we might be using now, like Zoom, right? It's not being done because the AFL-CIO is sending union organizers into, right? And also all these sorts of unaffiliated so-called salts, right? Radical workers who basically are joining workplaces in order to unionize them, right? In order to sort of basically unionize. This was also not unique to the IWW, right? But requires a level of commitment on the part of workers as opposed to union organizers. I'm not anti-union organizer, but both are necessary. But one is actually driving these, right? And so employers are afraid because like they should be, you know, like because there's much more sympathy towards unions today than in 60 plus years, supposedly.
You just been listening to a portion of a conversation from our archives. As we commemorate Labor Day this week here in the U.S., the show today featured a discussion from our archives that not only contextualizes labor as a broader category, but also how it leads to specific radical movements. The conversation between African Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope and Professor Peter Cole also focused on the role of African-American labor organizer Ben Fletcher of the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, also known as the Wobblies, in mobilizing workers in the early 20th century, connecting that movement's similarities to the new wave of unionizing that bypasses mainstream organizations. Dr. Peter Cole is professor and graduate director in the Department of History at Western Illinois University. Professor Cole researches on the history of social movements, especially how workers and labor unions organize in ethnically and racially diverse societies. He also maintains scholarly interests in history of African Americans, denationalization, South Africa, cities, technology, popular culture, historical memory, and the maritime world. He is a research associate in the Society, Work, and Development Institute of the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa. Cole is the founder and co-director of the Chicago Race Riot of 1919 Commemoration Project. He's written extensively, and his most recent book is Ben Fletcher, The Life and Writings of a Black Wobbly, which is a much revised and expanded edition of the earlier version written in 2006. The full conversation will be on African Now's SoundCloud page. That's African Now online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Gurima by Chinoiso Marere. That's it for African Now for today. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shanan and Zain Al-Amin, looking at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, which is followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, and that's followed by Human Rights and Justice with Nakichi Taifa. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter, and that's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online. That's Africa Now Online. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host, James Pope, and also thanks to our engineers, Michael Nasella and Kalia Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Kozer and Funangonda, and our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erderson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you with a closing song entitled Africa by Salif Keita. commemorating his birthday, which was on August 25. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week and stay safe.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Another round of Russian airstrikes killed 7 people in the western Ukrainian city of Lviv today, a day after one of the deadliest missile attacks of the war killed at least 53 people and wounded more than 200 others. Yesterday's strike hit a military academy and hospital in the central eastern city of Poltava, between the capital Kyiv and Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, near the Russian border. Today, Ukraine's foreign minister submitted his resignation as part of a cabinet reshuffle announced by President Zelensky last week. 4 other ministers also submitted resignations late yesterday. A Human Rights Watch report published today points the finger at Venezuelan police and pro-government militias for killings committed during protests following a contested presidential election in July. The report cites evidence tying Venezuela's National Guard and National Police to some of the 24 killings following the election, which was claimed by both President Nicolas Maduro and opposition candidate Edmundo González. A Venezuelan judge on Monday issued an arrest warrant for González after authorities accused him of crimes including conspiracy and falsifying documents. The Human Rights Watch report also said pro-government gangs, quote, appear to be responsible for some post-election killings. 23 of the people killed were protesters or bystanders, while 1 was a member of the National Guard. Thousands of anti-government protesters were arrested in the days after the election. Vote tally sheets collected by the opposition and published online showed González winning significantly more votes than had been reported by Maduro's government. In domestic news, Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris is in New Hampshire today to announce a plan to expand tax credits for small businesses. Harris is scheduled to campaign outside Portsmouth at a brewery that received a tax credit and installed solar panels with support from a Biden administration program. Harris's new tax proposal calls for credits of up to $50,000 for startup expenses, with a goal of incentivizing 25 million new small business applications over 4 years. The trip to New Hampshire is unusual for Harris at this point in her campaign, which has been focused on establishing a presence in large battleground states, including Michigan, Pennsylvania, Arizona, and Georgia. Harris spent her Labor Day in Detroit and Pittsburgh, and is returning to Pittsburgh tomorrow. A federal judge yesterday denied Donald Trump's request to move his New York hush money case to a federal court. Trump is due to be sentenced later this month in that case, in which he was found guilty on all 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to conceal payments to Stormy Daniels. Trump hoped to move the case to federal court so that he could seek to have his conviction overturned in the wake of the Supreme Court's ruling that presidents have immunity for official acts taken while in office. In his ruling yesterday, Judge Alvin Hellerstein found that there is nothing in the Supreme Court's ruling that changes the fact that the Trump payments to Daniels were, quote, private, unofficial acts. Moving the case to federal court would have also likely delayed sentencing until after the November election. And after one of the hottest summers on record, many cities across California and the U.S. Southwest are coping with a dangerous heat wave this week. Excessive heat warnings are in effect today through Friday across much of Southern California into far southern Nevada. In some areas, a strong heat dome could send temperatures soaring as high as 115 degrees. Excessive heat can cause heat-related illness, with the elderly, young children, and outdoor workers at the greatest risk. Climate change is intensifying heat waves while also raising their likelihood and duration. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 72 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 73 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening. Are you passionate about eradicating air pollution? Would you like to participate in the Environmental Justice